Radio, I'm Lisa Brady, saying she knows many Americans are frustrated.
If I am fortunate enough to be your president, I will have your back every single day that I serve.
Hillary Clinton detailing her plans for the U.S. economy at a Detroit-area aerospace company, pledging the biggest investment in good-paying jobs since World War II.
When it comes to creating jobs, I would argue it's not even close. Even conservative experts say Trump's agenda will pull our economy back into recession.
She also emphasizes infrastructure investment and wants to connect every U.S. household to broadband by the year 2020. Trump insists his plan is better for everyone, including the middle class.
We're having a massive cut in taxes. We're having a massive cut in regulations.
In a speech to a national home builders group in Miami Beach, Donald Trump also doubling down on controversial comments about ISIS after calling President Obama the group's founder because of his foreign policy and Clinton the co-founder.
ISIS will hand her the most valuable player award. Her only competition is Barack Obama between the two of them.
The Clinton campaign says Trump echoes the talking points of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Police in Canada now say a would-be terrorist killed in a confrontation with officers had been in contact last year with someone based in the UK who was later arrested for a terror plot in Australia.
Canadian authorities say that a man identified as Aaron Driver, an alleged ISIS sympathizer, wanted to kill himself and others using a bomb in a major Canadian city. The agency in charge of Toronto trains and buses tells Fox it was alerted about a possible terror plot. According to one report, Driver wanted to cause mass casualties.
Fox's David Lee Miller, police just releasing a martyrdom video that indicated a rush hour attack was in the final planning stages. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Peek-a-boo, peek-a-boo, smile.
Smile, buddy.
Come on, smile. Oh, honey, he's still not smiling.
Maybe he's not a smiler.
Yeah, maybe he's just not a happy baby.
Maybe he's just being a boy. You know how boys are.
Or maybe he's teething. Oh, poor baby, I think his gums hurt.
Maybe he's just tired.
Or maybe his tummy hurts. He didn't eat that much.
Maybe he's not ticklish.
You think maybe he's scared of the dog?
Maybe he'll outgrow it. Maybe it's a phase. Maybe he just doesn't like smiling.
Maybe he has autism, and we can definitely do something to help.
Maybe is all you need to find out more about autism. No big, joyful smiles by 6 months is one early sign. Learn the others at autismspeaks.org/signs or see a doctor today for an autism screening. The sooner it's diagnosed, the better. And it can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Several people still unaccounted for in an explosion and fire at an apartment complex in Silver Spring, Maryland, overnight. At least two people have been found dead in the ruins of the building, the cause under investigation. National forecasters out with an update on hurricane season.
The updated hurricane season outlook, the official long-term tropical weather forecast from NOAA, now says it is likely this year will produce as many as 12 named tropical storms, with between 5 and 8 becoming hurricanes, and of which 2 to 4 could become major hurricanes with wind speed faster than 110 miles an hour. NOAA's scientists say signs point to increased activity, and this updated prediction increases the expected number of storms. So far this year, 5 Atlantic tropical storms have formed, 2 of which struck the U.S. coast. Another 2 grew to hurricane status. In Miami, Eben Brown, Fox News.
Flight cancellations and delays extending into a fourth day for Delta Airlines passengers. The airline says some of the latest were due to the computer outage from earlier in the week and ongoing backlog, but others have been caused by bad weather. Investors seem to like Macy's new plan to close dozens of stores.
The nation's largest department store chain says it'll close about 100 stores next year and boost online investments as it tries to stay competitive after 6 consecutive quarters of declining sales. The retailer, which also operates the Bloomingdale's store, says 14% of its stores under the Macy's brand will go. It also says there will be a push to increase its exclusive products and a focus on stores with the highest growth potential. Amazon.com is, by some forecasts, expected to surpass Macy's as the largest online seller of clothing next year. Lillian Wu, Fox News.
Macy's shares have been soaring by double digits as the Dow soars to new heights, up 134 right now at 18,630.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina.
Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. Hi there. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today. It's Thursday, and a lot of big news just happening. A three-judge panel declaring North Carolina's state legislative districts are unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered, and that the North Carolina General Assembly must redraw the maps for next session. So apparently this upcoming election, the maps will be good to go as they are drawn now. And I know someone who's probably glad that at least this is getting put off for a little bit. Our guest joining us now, a very busy lady who has a lot on her plate, Kim Strack, Executive Director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
I bet you're glad to just get on the phone and do something besides look at maps and elections and who's going to do what, where, and when. And you've been busy, Kim.
It has been a busy couple of years, yes, and busy today, too.
I can imagine. So I guess you had heard about this judicial ruling that just breaking news a couple of minutes ago. What I wanted to chat with you about, and not necessarily get into any kind of who should have done what or this is right or wrong, but from your position as the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections, what kind of impact do these judicial rulings, particularly the striking down of the 2013 voter ID and other legislation there that was struck down, how's that going to affect the elections and what you at the Board of Elections have to do to make everything run smoothly?
Well, yeah, anytime the rules change, it has big impacts on anyone who is dealing anything with elections. And especially when the timing gets so close to an election, there's so many things that have to be done in preparation for elections. A lot of people don't understand that about the time it takes to prepare ballots, and absentee ballots go out well in advance of a general election, 60 days from a general election. So all those things start much earlier than probably people anticipate. And with specifically these laws, and in particular photo ID, for the past 3 years, the State Board of Elections, we have been trying to roll out photo ID for 2016, which we did in March and then again in June. And we have really tried to do everything we could over the past 2.5 years to make sure voters in North Carolina were prepared for it, that they knew that in 2016 they would need to bring photo ID, acceptable photo ID. Our outreach team has been all over the state trying to get that message out and trying to also identify voters that may not have an acceptable ID and ensure that they have that. We thought it was also a really important thing with implementing photo ID. This was a really good time to go to uniformity in our precincts. We've got 100 counties, and they're different, but a lot of the processes that people go through need to be the same so that the experiences in every county are the same. A voter gets the same experience. So we integrated photo ID. It's heavily integrated in that process, and we have put in place, starting in March, uniform procedures. So with this news, we don't want to lose uniformity in especially a presidential general election. So we've had to strip all of that out, and we've got to work to try to replace these uniformity tools in our precincts so that we still have that come November.
Well, guest Kim Strack, the executive director of the North Carolina Board of Elections here on What Matters in North Carolina, talking about 100 counties and you guys sort of overseeing all of this. From a practical standpoint, and I don't mean to be ignorant, but maybe our listeners don't know, who actually puts on these elections? Do you guys just oversee and it's up to the individual counties, or are you guys intimately involved there at the county level?
That's a very good question, and it is. It's the 100 county boards of elections who then have to hire basically volunteers. They get paid, but precinct officials that actually run the elections during early voting and on election day. The State Board of Elections, we're very involved. We're not the boots on the ground by any means, but the processes and procedures we put down to the counties for them to implement. So we're very involved in the process. But, yes, it's the county boards of elections and the precinct officials that actually they're the ones, the boots on the ground, that pull it off.
Do you have, like, for lack of a better words, can you tell them what to do, or can they say, well, we're gonna use this kind of ballot, and then another county says, well, no, we're going to use this kind of ballot, or you mentioned you're trying to get uniformity. Is that realistic, or are they allowed to do whatever they see fit there locally?
No, the State Board of Elections has a considerable amount of authority for that purpose of ensuring uniformity and making sure that our 100 counties are all compliant with North Carolina law. So we do have the authority to certainly make processes uniform, and the counties are very good about doing that. So we very rarely have problems with counties not wanting to follow what the uniform procedures are.
And Kim Strack of the North Carolina State Board of Elections, in terms of these judicial things that come down, you said you had implemented, and by the way, I personally thought you guys did a fabulous job getting the word out about the requirements for the photo ID and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you.
Is the can we expect things to be somewhat chaotic? And even though you guys are putting forth your best efforts, are people going to, you think, still be confused and people be showing their IDs and now the precinct workers have to tell them, well, you don't need to do that? And, you know, or do you have great optimism that everything is going to run very smoothly as far as from the actual voter standpoint of things?
I am optimistic. We're trying to think through all of those scenarios because I think you're right. A lot of those scenarios may happen. We may have voters that have heard the message for the past 2.5-3 years about the need to bring photo ID. They brought it in March. They brought it again in June. And there may be some confusion on that. We're working part of our uniform procedures that we're now having to change and take photo ID out of is addressing those situations so that we do have orderly experience in the precincts with anyone who shows up to vote. So I am optimistic. I think our precinct officials, our counties are really working hard. They understand the task that they have in front of them. They have the fact that they're going to have to train election officials that they've trained in March and June to implement photo ID. They're going to have to untrain them on that. But we hope that these uniform tools are going to really be an asset to them to try to address some of these issues that we can think of before they happen.
Our guest is Kim Strack, very hardworking, particularly of late with some of the judicial decisions that have come down affecting North Carolina's elections. She is the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. Do you ever see a time where everything is going to be digitally done, or is there too much of a risk of people hacking?
Well, I mean, I think we're always looking for ways that we can have more efficient elections where we can use technology and in a positive way. But I think one of the things that is I think we all need to be very careful about is not moving too fast in that until we're ready for it. And that's one of the things that we had hoped to focus more on, quite frankly, this year is looking at new certification of voting equipment to see what else is out there, to see if there are ways that we can bring technology more into elections, but ensuring that before we do that, that it's safe, it's secure, and that we're not putting anything with an election in jeopardy, because that's the last thing we want to do.
Well, absolutely. So in your office there, is your authority, is that statutory from the General Assembly? Or
yes.
So the General Assembly basically kind of gives you direction. Is there anything recently that has actually affected how you guys do your job other than, you know, these ancillary things as far as the judicial decisions, or have things been pretty much running the same for a good while over there at the Board of Elections?
I think they have been. I think the biggest challenge that we've had over the past couple of years has been the litigation and the changes that come with that, and the rules that may change, and having to be prepared to deal with that at any time, including at a time that is close to an election or at a time that we have are implementing other things, understanding that sometimes the courts don't understand the timelines for elections.
Well, apparently they don't seem to worry about that too much. So, Kim, in terms of this upcoming election, there, as we've talked, there's a lot of, 100 counties, multiple dozens of precincts everywhere. In terms of people showing up and being able to early vote, are you guys determining that, or is each individual county? Because I know in the news lately, there's been some talk, well, Wake County wants to do this, and then Guilford County wants to do that. Who did the individual counties set their early voting locations and actual times of day, or do you guys get intimately involved in that?
This is a very hot topic right now, because that is one of the provisions of the law that was struck down. Was when House Bill 589, the photo ID law that had other changes in it, we went from a 17-day early voting period to a 10-day early voting period. But the difference with the 10-day, something that had never happened with early voting, was that counties, in coming up with their plans, and it is the county boards of elections that come up with their individual plans of meaning where early voting is going to be and the hours, they had to match the number of hours to the last comparable election. At all of the sites had to be open the same number of hours and the same days. So you had some uniformity within the county. When this was struck down, we add another week to early voting, but the counties no longer have to comply with that matching hours requirement. So they still, the statute gives them the ability to have additional sites or not have additional sites. That was not an option prior to this part of the legislation being struck down. Each county, they didn't have to have a certain number of sites, but they certainly had to have enough sites to be able to maintain the number of hours for voting. So now what we have is everybody has gone having to go back to the drawing board under different rules and knowing that they have to be open during this 17-day period beginning October 20th. And each county board, the 3-member board, they can vote on where they want to be open during this time. And they have to be open by law at their Board of Elections office. So normal business hours during the 17 days, during business days and the last Saturday until 1 o'clock, they must be open at their Board of Elections. The 3-member county boards can vote to be open at additional sites, and those sites can be open at the hours that they determine, and they don't have to be at the same hours each day as other sites. So that we're right now in the process, and next Friday is the deadline for all counties to submit their plans to us. And as long as those plans are unanimous at the county board level and the sites that they have chosen are ADA compliant, those will be approved. The problem or issue where the state board comes into play is if a county is not unanimous, because they cannot move forward without a unanimous plan, and then it comes to the state board to be able to look at those plans and make a determination.
Well, I'm certainly glad you understand all of that and have a good handle on it, because it sounds like trying to herd cats.
It does. It is a little bit.
But Kim Strack, one final question. In terms of staffing and stuff like that, do you feel like you have enough people there in Raleigh to get everything done that you need to, or have you found yourself needing, to bring on additional people because of these judicial rulings, or do you think you're okay?
We actually do need probably some additional staff that we bring on temporary help where we need that. And one of the things that I hope that going forward, this legislation brought for the very first time a voter outreach team to the State Board of Elections. We've never had that. We've never had a PIO for public information, and those are time-limited positions. And I think we definitely need, the State Board of Elections definitely always needs to have a voter outreach team and a public information officer, because those two roles are critical to the voters of this state.
Well, your work is absolutely critical, and you're doing a fine job. I don't envy all that you have to do, but I appreciate that you are willing to put in the time and the hours to help the people of our state be able to get out and vote. And thank you for being our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there you go, folks. Kim Strack, Executive Director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections. And she sounded way too calm for somebody that's in the middle of all that she's got going on in the state, with the latest news being that a panel of federal judges has ruled that 28 out of 170 state legislative districts are unconstitutional because they are racially gerrymandered. And so this is not unexpected. The judiciary is on a roll, and who knows? Maybe Monday they will rule that our speed limit is unconstitutional. After all, you know, what right does a state have to set speed limits? And, hours of operation for retail stores. I think that that's something that we can expect the federal judiciary to weigh in on any day now and rule that all retail stores in North Carolina are operating unconstitutionally, and they need to be open longer, and they need to be open earlier so that people can shop. And so this is really, you know, I'm excited because it's time, really, that the federal judiciary gets more intimately involved in our state. I think that they should weigh in on NASCAR. You know, we have a lot of NASCAR here in North Carolina. The headquarters for many of the racing teams are down there in Mooresville. And I think they should weigh in on the length of racetracks. There's something unconstitutional about the length of the Charlotte Motor Speedway. I'm certain of it. And, you know, they used to race in Wilkesboro and Rockingham. I think they ought to force the state to make NASCAR put those races back. I mean, what is NASCAR doing, canceling races? There should be a three-judge panel that mandates where auto racing is held. I think the prices of concessions at Bank of America Stadium need to be looked at. I think that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, or at least a three-judge federal district judge panel, should weigh in on the price of beer at Bank of America Stadium. They should set the price of beer, because obviously anyone at the state level doing anything is unconstitutional. And so I'm looking forward to the federal judiciary getting more intimately involved in our state, as they have struck down a voter ID law that was not racist, that did not suppress anyone's vote. Now they're saying, after saying that the U.S. congressional districts were racially gerrymandered, now they're saying that the state and House legislative districts were racially gerrymandered. And so they're on a roll. And I think while you're on a roll, it's like being in Vegas. You know, if you got the dice in your hand and you're rolling sevens, keep rolling. So let's get these judges involved in our state in every possible way. I think what time people go to bed, you know, the city of Austin might be on to something here. No non-sleep activities in short-term rental housing after 10 p.m. Well, I think the federal judiciary should mandate in North Carolina that people have to go to bed by 9:30. So if you, that's it. It certainly cannot be constitutional to stay up past 9:30 at night. So we appreciate that the federal judiciary is looking out for our state. And we appreciate that Judge Mike Morgan, Superior Court Judge here in North Carolina, District Court Judge, trying to hold a voter ID trial, planning to move ahead on September 26th, even though he's running for the state Supreme Court. There's nothing wrong with that, is there? There's no reason for him to recuse himself. I mean, after all, you know, he's a judge. They don't do anything wrong. They don't ever get anything wrong. So, Wake County school board members, it says here in the News and Observer this morning, expressing relief they won't have to face off against each other in the November 8th election, since voters will elect members based on existing district maps rather than those drawn by state lawmakers. So, what do they say? It costs $50,000 a day to run the General Assembly when they're in session. I think we just cancel the upcoming session. That'll save a lot of money. Let the district courts draw not only Wake County's maps, since they've weighed in here, but let them go through and draw the maps for every school board in the state, 100 counties, 100 county school boards. Let them draw the maps. Let them draw the districts for every congressional seat, for every state Senate seat, for every state House seat, and just be done with it. And really, we don't need the General Assembly to pass any laws. Certainly, you know, like occupational licensing, they were looking at doing away with some of that. Well, let's just let the judiciary decide whether or not, for example, if you're an African hair braider, if you have to have a license, or if you're an auctioneer, if you have to have a license. Certainly, this is not within the purview of a local state legislature. The federal judicial system should be, at every turn, intimately involved in the legislation of North Carolina. And it doesn't matter that other states have modeled their voter ID legislation, for example, after North Carolina, and found by other judicial districts to be constitutional. That's just not important. We need more judicial activism. You know, I think whether or not people are allowed to go to church is something that just pick a three-judge panel at the federal level here and let them decide, maybe not whether or not people can go to church. That might be too blatant of an attack on the Constitution. But how about what time churches are open? Okay, so your Sunday morning service cannot start before 9 o'clock or any later than, say, 11. So, and maybe they should stagger. They should require churches to stagger their service times so that there's not big lines at restaurants. I think this would be a good idea. Get the federal judiciary involved in the starting and stopping times of houses of worship. So you could have your Baptists, you know, they roll in at 9. And then maybe your Methodists, they get to start at 9:15. So everybody's leaving like 15 minutes later than everybody else. And, you know, you're going to Golden Corral or Ryan's or somewhere like that. You're not worrying about a big line. I think this is an area that the federal judicial system needs to get involved in. And certainly they should be able to do that. And other things that really are the purview of the federal judiciary. So, like I said, when you're in Vegas and you're hot, you just keep rolling. And the left is hot right now. They are having a field day with their little run on the federal judicial system that they are having. And that's fine. I'm sure that the good folks in the General Assembly will redraw the maps as they did, as they were directed to for the congressional districts. They'll redraw the ones that that are in question here at the state level, and wouldn't surprise me at all if they did what they did with the congressional districts and announced that race will not be a factor at all. And Dan Blue bragging that, you know, he's run several times and won without, you know, his race being a majority-minority district. So he doesn't understand why they had to put more African-Americans in his district. And, you know, that's fine. He's been talking a lot lately. Maybe that's because his son is trying to be treasurer, which in my mind, I haven't seen anything in his resume that would warrant that, but that's another topic altogether. So Dan Blue making the rounds now, trying to help his son and trying to act like he's really ever been involved as an effective senator here in North Carolina. It's all very interesting the way this is playing out, and we'll talk about it some more. But first, we're going to take a break, get you caught up on your Fox News, and coming up, one of our favorite segments, Nick Oxner from WBTV. A lot on his plate. You're listening to the Freedom Action Network. This is What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. We will be right back.
Radio, I'm Lisa Brady.
Which candidate has a real plan to create good-paying jobs?
Hillary Clinton pitching her plan for the economy.
We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports.
Also reiterating the rich should pay their fair share in a Detroit-area speech, contrasting her proposals with Donald Trump's and insisting his plan would send the economy back into recession.
She's proposing huge amounts of spending for core infrastructure rebuilding in the United States, as is Mr. Trump, but she's proposing $275 billion in new spending to pay for universal pre-K as well as paid family leave.
Fox Business Network's Adam Shapiro. Trump says Clinton will end up hiking taxes on the middle class and that she doesn't have the talent to help the economy.
Home ownership is at its lowest rate in 51 years.
Trump telling home builders in Miami Beach that Clinton will mean four more years of President Obama's policies. He may have more headwinds coming from within his own party. Fox Radio's Rachel Sutherland, live in Washington.
Lisa, an open letter being sent next week to Republican National Committee head Reince Priebus says Trump's divisiveness, recklessness, incompetence, and unpopularity are threatening to turn the election into a Democratic landslide up and down the ballot. More than 70 Republicans signed on, asking Priebus to divert funding away from Trump and send it to Senate and House races across the country. Among the signers are former RNC staffers, as well as former Senator Gordon Humphrey of New Hampshire and former Congressman Tom Coleman of Missouri. A Quinnipiac poll shows some Republican senators are fighting to keep their seats in key swing states. Lisa.
Rachel, fire crews not sure yet what caused the explosion that sparked a deadly inferno at a Maryland apartment complex overnight, killing at least two, injuring dozens. Fox News Radio, fair and
real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then
this is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched, most trusted Fox News Channel.
There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
A House Republican task force report finds officials in the U.S. military's Central Command skewed intel reports to make it seem as if the war against ISIS and al-Qaeda is going better than it was.
Kansas Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo told Fox News that the report substantiates claims made by 50 whistleblowers at CENTCOM.
Senior analysts were providing data up to the very top of the intelligence community inside of CENTCOM, and they were changing that data.
The five-month investigation found no conclusive evidence that White House officials ordered the reports to be doctored.
Fox Radio's John Decker at the White House. A Pentagon Inspector General investigation is underway. Police in Canada say a would-be terrorist shot and killed in a confrontation may have been within 72 hours of launching an attack on a major urban target. He left behind a martyrdom video. Some security incidents at the Olympics.
Evgeny Korotishkin, a silver medalist in swimming at the London Games 4 years ago, says he was robbed at gunpoint near the popular Ipanema beach. The Russian, who is not competing in Rio, but here is an official with the country's swimming federation, posted on Instagram that he gave the two thieves everything he had in his pockets. That comes the same day three officers with Brazil's National Security Force were shot in a favela. They were using GPS to get around, but took a wrong turn into the slum. One was shot in the head and is in stable condition after 4 hours of surgery. At the Olympics in Rio, Chris Honig, Fox News.
There's late word that a Kenyan athletics coach has been sent home for Rio, accused of posing as an athlete and giving a urine sample. A Dutch sailor who competed on a polluted bay in Rio yesterday says she feels ill. Sailing's governing body says she's been evaluated by medical officials after her Olympic races yesterday. Not clear yet whether the illness is because of pollution in the water. An hour to the close on Wall Street, record territory. The Dow is up 124 points.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. Mark Shiver with you on a Thursday. One of our favorite segments is the time that we get to spend with Nick Oxner, investigative reporter with WBTV. Nick, welcome back to the program, sir.
Hello, how are you?
Well, I'm doing well. You've been right busy.
yes, that's a very good way to put it.
Well, I'm looking at a big headline here, lawsuit, Trump campaign failed to act after staffer pulled gun. That sounds a little nerve-wracking there. Can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah, so a lawsuit was filed yesterday afternoon by a former Trump campaign worker here in North Carolina who lives here in Charlotte. And the lawsuit essentially says that the then North Carolina state campaign director for Trump's campaign pulled a loaded weapon on him as the two were driving down the road in a Jeep in South Carolina in February during the primary.
Wow. That sounds, I mean, was I'm reading the story here, but it doesn't sound like a whole lot of, have we found out why?
No, as a matter of fact, we haven't found out why. And I did an interview this morning with the former staffer who filed the lawsuit, Vincent Bordini, and he told me he pulled the gun. They had an exchange about why are you pulling a loaded gun on me? I'm paraphrasing. And then they basically went back to normal and kept driving down the road.
Well, Nick, people do this all the time. I don't know what the problem is. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've been driving down the road and somebody's pulled a gun on me. This is crazy, man. So I guess Earl Phillip is the person being sued, the former Trump staffer.
Along with the Trump campaign, that's right.
Have you gotten a chance to talk with Mr. Phillip?
No, I've not. I called several numbers for him and his business that I could find and have left voicemails, haven't talked to him. Also interesting, you know, that the Trump campaign is also named as a defendant in this lawsuit. I emailed campaign spokesman Hope Hicks this morning, also have not heard back from them.
Well, do you think this is going to be resolved soon? Is this the kind of thing that drags out? What is your take on how long?
In the words of the plaintiff here, Mr. Bordini, he told me today, this is now in the hands of a jury, so we'll see what happens.
Well, how did you hear about this? I mean, dude, you're really good. I mean, you are just, stuff you come up with is amazing.
I'd say the job of all of my colleagues and I are to have our ear to the ground, and we like to do that as much as possible.
Now, the Trump campaign here in your story, basically, it says nothing happened. So they did not look into this, investigate, respond.
Well, no one's responded to me. I mean, it seems like Mr. Bordini says he reported this all the way up to, you know, Corey Lewandowski, who at the time was the Trump campaign manager. They said, we'll look into this, we take this seriously, and then Mr. Bordini says they didn't do anything. And in fact, the lawsuit claims that a similar incident with Mr. Phillip pulling a gun on a staffer occurred with up to four other staffers.
Oh, wow. That's, I don't mean to laugh. That's just outrageous. I mean, I can't imagine.
Yes.
So, it's in the hands of a jury, according to Mr. Bordini. Our guest is Nick Oxner, and he, of course, is with WBTV. Now, another story that you broke almost a week ago now, I guess published last Friday, not quite a week ago.
Time flies when you're having fun.
Exactly. A Raleigh attorney has had a lobbying complaint filed against him. He apparently has ties to Speaker of the House Tim Moore and the insurance commissioner, Wayne Godwin. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so that complaint essentially accuses attorney and lobbyist Mark Bibbs of lobbying the General Assembly while not being registered as a lobbyist. The complaint was filed, was that last week? I basically forget what week it is. It was recently filed. How about that? Recently filed against Mr. Bibbs, and Mr. Bibbs has yet to respond, but records show that he did not register as a lobbyist for 2016 until July, after the session had concluded, and we were able to obtain email correspondence, some of which was attached to the complaint, showing that Mr. Bibbs had been actively emailing members of the General Assembly and advertising himself as a lobbyist in the month of June. That would be before he had registered this year.
So this involves, I'll be honest with you, when I looked at the story, I felt like it was more inclined to negatively reflect more directly on the insurance commissioner. Although one can assert that, you know, certainly as the Speaker of the House, Tim Moore should have been aware of who is and isn't a registered lobbyist and maybe stepped in to stop some of this activity. But this doesn't look good for the insurance commissioner at all, in my opinion.
That could be a fair assumption. I think, you know, our story, so in addition to the complaint, we also, separately from the complaint, had obtained records from the Department of Insurance that we requested this spring, documenting communication between Mark Bibbs, the lobbyist, and Wayne Goodwin. And included in that communication that we got were text messages between Bibbs and Goodwin, and we published the entirety of the text messages as provided to us by the Department of Insurance on our website with our story. And included in there is some texts where Bibbs is telling Goodwin, kind of updating him. They're both Democrats. Mark Bibbs ran for the House of Representatives as a Democrat. Wayne Goodwin, the elected insurance commissioner, is a Democrat. They're both Democrats, and Bibbs is giving Goodwin an update on Speaker Moore's plans to select committee leadership for the House Republican caucus. And go so far as to ask him who he'd like to see as a committee chairman for a particular committee. And so I think, at the very least, that's where Mr. Bibbs' ties to Speaker Moore comes in.
Okay, gotcha. So this is fascinating, reading text messages. Like, this is really cool.
You know, my job is to try to get access to records that people want to read.
Yeah, well... So. Yeah, there's something voyeuristic about reading somebody's text messages, so I probably need to not enjoy doing this as much as I am. So our guest is Nick Oxner, investigative reporter with WBTV. Nick, some of this stuff, you know, obviously I'm sure that Mr. Bibbs nor the insurance commissioner Godwin ever thought that, you know, I would be sitting here reading these at this point in time, or anyone else for that matter.
Yes, although it's important to point out that the insurance commissioner provided these records to us in response to a records request. So I do want to take a second to point out just the fact that whether he ever intended for us to read them or not, Commissioner Goodwin did recognize that they were a public record and did provide them in response to a public records request, which, frankly, a lot of officials that I try to request text messages from, you know, aren't so quick to do that.
Yeah, so, yeah, I was going to ask you. I guess I didn't know text messages were part of public records, so.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. In fact, we have a completely unrelated story airing tonight on WBTV at 7 o'clock about some local officials who we found deleted some text messages that we had requested for an investigation we were working on. And we requested the record, and the city came back and said, oh, those were deleted. And so, yeah, any kind of written communication that involves city or, you know, public, the public's business is a public record.
Well, so getting off topic here, what are you going to do with that? I mean, do you go all the way, Can you request the provider to recreate those, or you just...
As I understand it, the provider doesn't retain the actual data from a text message. They just know that a text was sent. Okay. So, yeah, in a perfect world, let's snap my fingers, I'd be able to get them. But it basically, what am I going to do about it? I'm going to do a story about it. That's about all we can do. It doesn't bring the record back, but I guess it, you know, that's our job to inform the public when things like that happen.
Well, you certainly do an excellent job of keeping the public informed. So there's been a lawsuit filed by Robert Brawley. And what I thought was interesting was that Mr. Bibbs was claiming to represent the company that Mr. Brawley has an ownership stake in. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's a company called Canon Surety Company. And I think really the complaint, the ethics complaint filed against Mr. Bibbs by Mr. Brawley was really prompted when Mr. Brawley saw Bibbs register as a lobbyist for Canon Surety. And Brawley said, well, wait a second, I'm the secretary of the board of Canon Surety, and I didn't know anything about this.
Well, so you don't think Brawley is somehow after the fact angry, and so now he's filing this complaint, or do you really feel like he didn't really know what was going on?
I don't know what he did or didn't know, but I do know that the complaint makes some allegations that are supported by what appear to be basic facts. So, you know, we publish those facts.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to say the least. And is this going to result in, if it goes against Mark Bibbs, the lobbying compliance division, how far could that go? Is this, he's violated state law, allegedly. Is there, what kind of ramifications could there be from this?
That's a really good question, and at one point I had looked that up, and that has since flown right out of my head. I mean, just being completely honest with you, I don't even want to hazard a guess at this point for right this second.
Okay.
I should know that. You've caught me. An uncharacteristic moment.
Wow. That is rare. Well, Nick, is there anything else that I know you're working all the time. Can you clue us in on anything that you've got coming up?
You know, we continue our investigation into the VA and the VA Choice Program, which you've allowed me some time to talk about several other times. We have another one of those stories coming up next week.
Okay.
And other than that, we continue to ask questions that a lot of people don't want to answer all across the state. So, and next time we do that, I'm sure in a couple of weeks I'll be happy to talk about it.
Well, are you getting any pushback from Speaker Moore's office about this situation, or have you really not really gone to them a whole lot?
Yeah, I did reach out. No, well, I did reach out to them, and I said, you know, look, there are these text messages. Based on the text messages, it appears that there's a relationship between the two. Do you want to comment on it? And I did not get a response back to my specific question on whether or not the Speaker's office wanted to comment on it.
Okay. Well,
that's
I guess.
Question. Well, we got no answer.
Well, I'm sure that won't be the last time you ask, and because you're very good at following up and making people uncomfortable, Nick. I think that's the
you
job
said
title.
It not me.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody's got to do it out there in the in the land of journalism and media. So you're doing a really good job. We appreciate all that you do. We appreciate what you bring to our program, and I know you've got a schedule, so I'll let you get out a little early. But thanks for being with us again here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
All right. Nick Oxner there. And so reading some personal text messages. This is Bibbs to Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin. Was I calling him Godwin? I don't know. Anyway. Hey, buddy, I've been recommended for the AHIP account. Need your help, please. W, which apparently is Wayne. Is there someone you need to be called? And then Mr. Bibbs. Mark Fleming made the recommendation. Chris McClure at Brooks Pierce reps United Healthcare. He needs to be on board. They both have the contact info. Do you want their cell or do you have them? Thanks so much. And this right here is just what this says is... what goes on behind the scenes, nobody will ever know unless you get a lobbying complaint filed against you and a public records request made for text messages. And all of a sudden, you have people like Mark Shiver reading them on the air. But I like this one. This is Mr. Bibbs. Good morning, my friend. I'm going to email you from now on, unless it's official, on your personal email. You and your guests are invited to a private Christmas party this Thursday night in the wine cellar at the Angus Barn. It's being hosted by my client, AAI. That's Roland. Please come. We can talk in private alone. So there you go. That's how politics is done here in North Carolina and I'm sure elsewhere. Wayne Goodwin getting to go to the Angus Barn in the wine cellar. So how about that? Not a bad gig if you can be the insurance commissioner and get people taking you to the Angus Barn wine cellar for a Christmas party. So there's more. You can go to WBTV.com and look at the story that our good friend Nick Oxner wrote. And there's all kind of personal cell phone information here for people if you care about that and you want some lobbyists' cell phone numbers. There's some stuff redacted. I wonder what that was. Well, anyway, thanks to Nick Oxner. You know, I bet people really don't like to see him coming. They used to say about Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes that if you saw him coming, you really knew you were going to have a bad day with 60 Minutes rolled into your office. And Nick Oxner is that guy here in North Carolina. And the folks at the General Assembly probably don't get a big smile on their face when he comes rolling up, cameraman in tow. Because Nick is typically hot on the trail of something that will make somebody uncomfortable when it's talked about on the news. And but that's his job, and he does it very well. So this whole thing with Earl Phillip of the Trump campaign, apparently, this is just bizarre, alleged to have pulled a gun on a Trump campaign staffer while riding down the road, just pulled the gun out and stuck it against the guy's knee and didn't say a word. And so the staffer, Vincent Bordini, as Nick was telling us, filed a lawsuit against Mr. Phillip and against the campaign. And, there's gotta be more here. I mean, you don't just drive down the road and pull out a gun and stick it against somebody's leg and don't say a word and then put it back. I mean, our producer, Matt Calder, you're a gun guy. Do you just occasionally pull your gun out and stick it against somebody's leg?
I'm just, no.
Okay.
No. So. Did it say that, though? I haven't actually tracked this story. Did it say that he put it against the guy's leg?
It says, Phillip, this is quoting here, Phillip pushed the barrel into Vincent's knee. The barrel's pressure crinkled Vincent's blue jeans. Phillip ominously stared sidewise at Vincent while driving the Jeep down the road and the barrel into Vincent, the complaint claims.
When he says buckle up, he means buckle up now.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe he changed the radio station. But anyway, this is certainly not good news for Trump here in North Carolina, obviously not involving him. But, there was a big shakeup in the Trump campaign. And I don't know if this had to do with that. But certainly Earl Phillip is no longer the Trump campaign director here in North Carolina. He does have a role in the campaign. I don't know if it's officially involved in the campaign, but he has been going out talking to minorities about why they should support Donald Trump. So he's still supporting Trump, it would appear, and making some comments in favor of people supporting Donald Trump here in North Carolina. Well, I saw this, and we'll definitely have to talk Tuesday, actually, with our friends from Americans for Prosperity, Nevada starting to pull the plug on solar subsidies. And this has got some people all up in arms. Nevada taxpayers, just like here in North Carolina, have been spending millions subsidizing homeowners who install rooftop solar panels. But that's about to end. According to Fox News, the state is phasing out that subsidy over the next 12 years. People are protesting, suing, and, you know, the Supreme Court in Nevada ruled that a referendum from solar activists challenging this decision would not be allowed on the November ballot. So the argument from the solar folks is that, oh, we create so many jobs and we're helping so many people in clean energy and blah, blah, blah. And the argument for the folks that are not convinced about solar is that if you are such a wonderful industry, why can't you stand on your own? Why do you have to have government subsidies? Why do the taxpayers who work hard for their money have to subsidize your industry? And that's really the bottom line. That is the question, and I think it's a legitimate question. Well, in Nevada, it would appear that Paul Thompson, chairman of Nevada's Public Utility Commission, said that this perk that homeowners say, if you put solar panels on your roof in Nevada, the you get a subsidy. Roughly 17,000 customers are getting about $16 million every year. This is called net metering, which reimburses residential energy customers for excess power generated by their rooftop panels. So, in a very common sense comment, Paul Thompson, chairman of Nevada's Public Utility Commission, said, quote, as the rooftop solar industry has gotten larger and larger, we've seen this subsidy grow. What started as a legislative policy to kickstart the industry, now 18 years later, it's time for that industry to stand on its own two feet. And that's the end of that quote. So that's what people here in North Carolina have been saying about solar for quite some time. And there's quite a division, even among the Republican majority in the North Carolina General Assembly about solar. But those that question the subsidy, the continued use of taxpayer dollars for renewable energy, and there's a variety of ways that you're being dinged for this. But the bottom line is, here's the question. Isn't it time the industry stand on its own two feet? Oh, well, solar and renewable energy and blah, blah, blah. You can, you know, well, that's what you get from the folks who are, you know, rabid renewable energy folks. But it's a legitimate question. If you're such a great industry, why can't you exist without being propped up by the government? Hello, that's a good question. Oh, well, Mark, you see the renewable energy standards and the clean energy and on. And I really don't have an answer, but we need the government subsidies because we do such a good job of, creating jobs and cleaning up the air. And why can't you stand on your own if you're so great? You see? And in Nevada, they've finally gotten some, fortitude behind that question. And they're going to start phasing out this subsidy for folks that have rooftop solar. Now, the customers are getting a little ticked off because as the state phases out net metering, some of the monthly fixed fees for solar customers, $12.75 to $38.51. They're saying the governor and the Public Utilities Commission have backstabbed us, some of these solar customers are saying. Some homeowners are saying, well, we wouldn't have shelled out thousands of dollars to go solar, saying that basically it was a bait and switch type thing put upon them by the Nevada Public Utility Commission. Many solar companies there are downsizing. Several, including Solar City, have stopped doing business in the state, eliminating 550 jobs. So the bottom line is that the question remains, and it will always remain, that if this is such a viable, strong, healthy, necessary, needful industry, why can it not stand on its own? Is there ever going to come a time when solar and wind and whatever else can exist as a viable industry without having to be propped up by your tax dollars and mine? That is a legitimate question, one that they are addressing in Nevada, one that has been offered forth here in North Carolina, but there are those in the General Assembly that aren't quite ready yet to answer that question. And so the subsidies and favorable treatment will continue for the foreseeable future here in North Carolina. All right, in the real foreseeable future, we've got Bob Lipke, Civitas Senior Education Policy Analyst, on the other side of our Fox News break. Coming up right now, you're listening to Freedom Action Network. This is What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lisa Brady.
Which candidate has a real plan to create good-paying jobs?
Hillary Clinton pitching her plan for the economy.
We will put Americans to work, building and modernizing our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our railways, our ports, our airports.
Also reiterating the rich should pay their fair share in a Detroit area speech, contrasting her proposals with Donald Trump's and insisting his plan would send the economy back into recession.
She's proposing huge amounts of spending for infrastructure rebuilding in the United States, as is Mr. Trump, but she's proposing $275 billion in new spending to pay for universal pre-K as well as paid family leave.
Fox Business Network's Adam Shapiro. Trump says Clinton will end up hiking taxes on the middle class and that she doesn't have the talent to help the economy.
Home ownership is at its lowest rate in 51 years.
Trump telling home builders in Miami Beach that Clinton will mean four more years of President Obama's policies. He may have more headwinds coming from within his own party. Fox Radio's Rachel Sutherland, live in Washington.
Lisa, an open letter being sent next week to Republican National Committee head Reince Priebus says Trump's divisiveness, recklessness, incompetence, and unpopularity are threatening to turn the election into a Democratic landslide up and down the ballot. More than 70 Republicans signed on, asking Priebus to divert funding away from Trump and send it to Senate and House races across the country. Among the signers are former RNC staffers, as well as former Senator Gordon Humphrey of New Hampshire and former Congressman Tom Coleman of Missouri. A Quinnipiac poll shows some Republican senators are fighting to keep their seats in key swing states. Lisa.
Rachel, fire crews not sure yet what caused the explosion that sparked a deadly inferno at a Maryland apartment complex overnight, killing at least two, injuring dozens. Fox News Radio, fair and
real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched. Most trusted. Fox News Channel. There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
A House Republican task force report finds officials in the U.S. military's Central Command skewed intel reports to make it seem as if the war against ISIS and al-Qaeda is going better than it was.
Kansas Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo told Fox News that the report substantiates claims made by 50 whistleblowers at CENTCOM.
Senior analysts were providing data up to the very top of the intelligence community inside of CENTCOM. And they were changing that data.
The five-month investigation found no conclusive evidence that White House officials ordered the reports to be doctored.
Fox Radio's John Decker at the White House. A Pentagon Inspector General investigation is underway. Police in Canada say a would-be terrorist shot and killed in a confrontation may have been within 72 hours of launching an attack on a major urban target. He left behind a martyrdom video. Some security incidents at the Olympics.
Evgeny Korotishkin, a silver medalist in swimming at the London Games 4 years ago, says he was robbed at gunpoint near the popular Ipanema beach. The Russian, who is not competing in Rio, but here is an official with the country's swimming federation, posted on Instagram that he gave the two thieves everything he had in his pockets. That comes the same day three officers with Brazil's National Security Force were shot in a favela. They were using GPS to get around, but took a wrong turn into the slum. One was shot in the head and is in stable condition after 4 hours of surgery. At the Olympics in Rio, Chris Honig, Fox News.
There's late word that a Kenyan athletics coach has been sent home for Rio, accused of posing as an athlete and giving a urine sample. A Dutch sailor who competed on a polluted bay in Rio yesterday says she feels ill. Sailing's governing body says she's been evaluated by medical officials after her Olympic races yesterday. Not clear yet whether the illness is because of pollution in the water. An hour to the close on Wall Street, record territory. The Dow is up 124 points. This is Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. It's a wonderful Thursday, and my name is Mark Shiver. You're on the Freedom Action Network. This is our time where every couple of weeks we get together and talk with Bob Lipke from the Civitas Institute. Before we do that, in case you haven't heard, a federal three-judge panel has ruled that 28 of the state's 170 legislative districts are unconstitutional because they are racially gerrymandered. And so they said that elections may proceed this year because postponing them would cause undue disruption, but the legislature must redraw the districts in the next legislative session to be used in 2018. So, Bob Lipke, I was saying earlier that these federal judicial system is on quite a roll, kind of like when you get to Vegas and you can't quit rolling sevens, so you just keep rolling those dice. And I think they should get more involved in our state. And maybe just do away with the General Assembly.
Yeah, that was
entirely.
My thinking. We'd save some money there.
Yeah.
We'd save a lot of money.
You know, so just let them decide, I don't know, how fast we can drive. I was saying earlier, maybe how much Bank of America Stadium could charge for beer at Panthers home football games.
There's just nothing outside the purview.
Yeah, no, just turn it all over to them and make life a whole lot more simpler. Well, one thing that's not simple is the issue of teacher compensation. And that is because the left often, let's see, what's a good word? Misrepresents, lies, maybe that's it, about what really takes place in North Carolina and has taken place when it comes to teacher compensation. If you get on any kind of social media, you know, you read these scathing assertions by the left that teachers are making, you know, $1.75 an hour, and the Republicans would like to take it on down to 85 cents an hour. But really, the truth is that under the last 5 years of Republican leadership in the General Assembly, teachers have gotten raises, and there's a lot more to their compensation than just their salary. So, Bob Lipke, let's talk about teacher compensation here in North Carolina.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I wanted to look more into this for a couple of reasons, because it is election time again, and I'm not saying that, you know, we're taking the Republican position on all this. We're looking to basically put under a microscope these charges, you know, that basically Republican policies are running the schools into the ground, you know, that teachers are starved for money, for resources in the classroom, that our schools are underfunded, and that for the last 6 years of Republican leadership, we've had nothing but bad news. So we've heard that the last two election cycles. We've heard pretty much nothing but bad news regarding the public schools. And so it's really important to find out, well, you know, what's really going on. We've got 6 years of of the legislature being under Republican leadership now. Basically, that means that they pretty much write the budget. They are in charge of policymaking, you know, which pretty much dictate the direction of legislation. So it's fairly easy to look at numbers, budget numbers, teacher pay, et cetera, what Republicans have done and what Democrats have done. And that's kind of what I've done in these last two papers. And the results, I think, for most people are pretty surprising.
Well, you know, I'll never forget, and I think I've told you this story before, but as you recall, in the Senate race between then Representative Tom Tillis and Senator Kay Hagan, man, they just carpet bombed night after night after night. Tom Tillis has cut education spending in North Carolina by $500 million. And I mean, just every channel, every other minute, this same commercial, that same negative, somber voice. And the fact was that it wasn't true. I was working over there. I had the budget on my desk. I knew that there was no $500 million cut in education. And yet, you know, the old saying is you tell a lie long enough, people will believe it. Well,
I think that was a case where it backfired.
Well, here's what I read that happened. I don't know if I've shared this part with you or not, but there was a poll done after that election, and one polling company published their finding that said that undecided voters had the last couple of weeks before the election gone and done their own research, discovered that they were being lied to, got angry about it, and voted for Tillis, and that's why he won. Now, I don't know if that's true. I don't know the veracity of that. I can't even remember now, because that was, 2 years ago, who the polling company was. But it made really good sense to me, because in this age of people being able to go on the internet and look things up for themselves, it did backfire. They were caught telling something that wasn't true. And I think, Bob, they do the same thing when it comes to teacher pay here in North Carolina.
It's happened a lot. It's happened with budgets. It's happened with teacher pay. If you look at the numbers, I mean, the fact of the matter is, for the last 6 years, five of the last six budgets that Republicans have proposed with regards to K-12 education, I mean, they've gone up every year but one. That's a fact. That's a fact. The total difference in the last 6 years, we've basically added $1.1 billion in inflation-adjusted dollars to the education budget. And that would I think this year we added about $314 million. Okay, so that, I mean, those facts pretty much undercut everything that the Democrats and the liberal left is trying to say about education, about there being nothing but basically scraps available for the public schools, no money for school supplies, no money for teacher pay, et cetera. It's just simply not true.
Yeah. Well, you wrote in the third installment of this series on teacher compensation, something that I would imagine a lot of people are not aware of. And that is, if you think about teacher compensation, not only has it gone up over the last 5 years, but the value of their benefits has gone up as well. And people don't like to talk about that, but really when you pay someone, Bob, you have to include the value of benefits. And teachers get health insurance, they get retirement, and all of that. And you cannot say, well, that doesn't count. Well, because it does.
Yeah, that's really the other side of teacher pay that has really been conspicuously absent in this debate, and that is, what are we paying with regards to benefits? Now, when we're talking about that, we're talking about usually health insurance, we're talking about retirement benefits, we're talking about Social Security. Social Security in this case is about 7.6% that's added. I mean, that comes in the form of a benefit. But the only other change is what's changed in that equation in the last dozen years that we looked at is, you know, what's the state pays for health insurance per education employee and what's also paid for retirement benefits. Both of those figures have gone up dramatically in the last dozen years, whether it be under Republicans or Democrats. I mean, the increase has happened under both types of leadership. It's gone up a little less under Republicans, but in both cases, I mean, it's much higher than what people think.
Well, in terms of these kinds of benefits, I mean, people oftentimes only want to count things like their take-home pay yep. as their compensation. But when you are provided health insurance, let me tell you something. You go out in the market and try to buy it on your own right now. That's an expensive proposition.
Yeah.
And so the fact that the state is providing that for teachers, you know, paying the employee cost or maybe paying the lion's share of it, that's a big deal.
Yeah, it's about, with regards to health insurance, this year it's about $5,600 per employee.
Really?
Originally, when we started looking at this about 12 years ago, which was about 2004, 2005, it was about $3,400, if I recollect correctly. So the point is, there's been a dramatic increase in it. But even larger than that has been the big increase in retirement benefits, which now the state is providing about 16.12% of the person's salary in the retirement fund. That's gone up markedly. Now, what does that mean, you know, with regards to the average salary? Basically, in our analysis, we went back about 12 years, okay? And the average value of benefits in, say, 2005, 2006 was about $10,100. What it is now is it's about $17,000. Okay, so what that means, for example, if the average teacher that starts this year, or that is being paid, say, $50,000,
right,
their actual total compensation is actually $67,000 when you factor in the benefits. Now, when people talk about that, it frames that whole discussion in a little different fashion.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, it's $67,000 is a much, you know, it's totally different.
Well, and, you know, I think the point that really needs to be made, and by the way, folks, you can read Bob Lipke's work. He is the education policy analyst. Senior education policy analyst at the Civitas Institute. You can go to civitas.org, ncivitas.org, and find his work there. But you mentioned that since 2005 and 2006, the consumer price index has increased a total of 22.9%. Teachers have received pay raises totaling 36.2%. Other teacher compensation increasing about 25%. So there's this picture, and I guess that the Democrats have found that they can, you know, put a face on teachers and talk about all the children that they care so much about. And that's why this makes a really good emotional issue for them to slap people around with every time that there's an election. But the fact of the matter is, teachers are not underpaid. Can I say that, well, or am I going to get somebody going to punch me?
I would say we do have a teacher pay problem. The teacher pay problem, and we're addressing it. But the teacher pay problem, in many respects, is man-made, because we tie teacher pay to a structure. We tie it to years of experience and certifications, and not to what's added in the classroom, which is much different than the rest of the labor force.
Yeah.
Okay? That is the problem. Now, if we get rid of, you know, that existing structure, in which we've tried to hammer at, and we have hammered at the last couple of years, but I believe our teacher pay problem would be largely vanquished if we got rid of the teacher salary schedule. Because it's an artificial construct, and it does not help things. why it's a problem is oftentimes it if you are in a school and you are a very good teacher, say you're a third grade teacher, you are one of the best teachers in the school. But say there's another teacher in there that is the same age, has been there the same amount of time, doesn't have to be, you know, as good a teacher as you are. Unfortunately, you are often trapped, you know, on the same salary track, and you will be paid for much of your career the same salary, or pretty much along the same lines.
So even though you're doing a better job,
there's no incentive to excellence.
Right.
Now, of course, people will say, well, we can provide additional incentives and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. And people even, because of the shortcomings of the salary schedule, recognize that, and they provide local salary supplements, which is an admission in many respects that it does not work. Now, why I say this is that the teacher pay problem is largely a result of the teacher salary schedule.
Hmm. Well, the Democrats froze the salary schedule, correct, in 2009?
Mm-hmm.
And yet they hold themselves out as being the guardians of teacher pay, the purveyors of, you know, huge raises for teachers. And it's just not true. And, I mean, what I find amazing, and I've said this, people are probably tired of hearing it, but when the Republicans came to town, there was a $3 billion deficit, Bob, or almost $3 billion. They had frozen teacher pay. They had a sales tax that was taking $1 billion out of the public's pockets, and they still couldn't balance a budget. And they'd left with this gigantic, you know, deficit. So the Democrats, to me, had mismanaged our state's money. People want to say, well, Mark, there was a recession. Well, you know, just because there was a recession doesn't mean that you have to leave the state in the dire straits that you did.
Yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess. And unfortunately, most of the Democrats think that history begins in 2012.
And, exactly.
And if you look at what happened, you know, from 2005-06 until 2010-11, which was the last year that they were in, they cut about $1.5 billion from the education budget. There were thousands of teachers that were laid off. They don't like to talk about it, but that was the reality. You can see it in the numbers. Okay, it's in the numbers. And they actually, if you look at from 2005-06 until 2010-11, their last budget, the actual number of dollars went down. About 500. It was about $500,000. The total net trend was down about $500,000. A half a billion. It was 500. Yeah. $4 million. So if I was a Democrat, I would understand why I wouldn't want to talk about that. But the fact is, you can't whitewash history that way.
So in terms of this past legislative session, we saw teachers getting across the board about a 4% raise.
4.7.
4.7% raise. And somebody, Governor McCrory, had posted something on Facebook, as his staff is known to do, some real positive thing about the state, and some companies coming and adding jobs, you know, some positive thing. And I was looking at the comments, and it was just unbelievable the vitriol that's still out there, and people talking about teacher pay as if, you know, we were running teachers out of the state. People still using that tired and played, comment that teachers are leaving. I mean, it's like the same bullet points just keep getting rehashed over and over again, and people hear them. And it's really sad, Bob, that these people, they don't even know the truth, and yet they spew this hate towards the governor and the General Assembly. And it's really just,
I don't know. I don't know how to respond to that somehow or another. I mean, people say, well, it wasn't a 4.7% raise for everybody. In effect, that's true. It was an average. When you average it across all teachers, it came to about a 4.7% increase.
Yeah.
Now, I think most people would have been happy, you know, especially when you realize this is the third pay raise they've had in a row.
Yeah.
You know, and they've had of the last 6 years, they've had four pay raises. Now, in the previous 6 years before that, Democrats had 4 and 6 years, but there were two. I mean, there were four rough years in there because of the recession, you know, and teachers, you know, they had to go without like a lot of other people did. So now I think understandably we're trying to make up, but it evidently isn't fast enough for some people.
Well, and I think some people are just going to be hateful no matter what you do, you know, no matter what the truth is, no matter how good a job, you know, the legislature or the governor does, they're just going to, you know.
Oftentimes when you run into a situation like that, I mean, inevitably, you're never going to be able to please all people. But this is so chronic on the left that they say, well, this is not enough money for the schools, or it's not enough money for teachers, et cetera. I mean, call people on their bluffs. You know, if $8.4 billion is not enough for the public schools, you know, and granted, this is not a perfect world. We all live within, you know, certain resource limitations. You know, I think people should be called exactly on, well, how much is enough? How much is enough? But you will never get anyone to articulate an actual amount, because that means that they would be accountable for, you know, what happens then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I said earlier, teachers are not underpaid, and I'm sure somebody would very aggressively and vigorously disagree with that statement. But I said that as a reflex almost when looking at what you had printed here, that their benefits and salary and retirement benefits, health insurance, Social Security averages up to around $67,000 a year. That's not bad compensation for any well, I mean, I guess, you know, there are people that make six figures or seven figures that would say that's bad. But, you know, you get the feeling from the way they present the issue that, you know, oh, teachers, you know, they're making minimum wage and they can't afford to eat and, you know, they can't afford to buy Kleenex for their classroom. And it just goes on and on. And it's just not the case.
No, it's not the case. And, every issue has a shelf life,
and well, this one's a long one.
You know, this is a long one, but I'd be happy to, you know, to start turning the corner on this, because I think, I mean, this has been on the top of the legislative agenda for the last 2-3 years, and I think they've taken you know their best hits at it in the last couple of years, and I think there are a lot of people. I mean, you get the people that are carping and saying this is not enough, but I know there are teachers that are happy that we've begun to address it and have at least recognized their efforts. Well, they do not write op-eds, nor do they, you know, get, you know, on Facebook and so forth and say so, but I know there are people like that out there.
Well, and the thing, and we'll need to wrap it up, but the thing I was saying the other day is, Bob, there's so much money that's spent on public education, billions and billions and billions of dollars year after year after year after year. And, you know, we've talked before about, you know, Senator Berger had to come in and pass legislation mandating the kids be able to read. We've got students. Senator Barefoot drafted a bill and had it passed where community college teachers are going into high schools because seniors and juniors are coming out of high school and they can't read at grade level. So throwing money at this has not helped. The billions of dollars that have been spent in public education in North Carolina, you tell me that when colleges say the biggest problem they have is that freshmen can't read, something's wrong somewhere.
Yeah, that's a good point on which to end on, because in no way was I arguing in either of these papers that we need to spend more money.
Yeah.
It was an attempt to set the record straight.
Oh, no.
In fact, even this morning, there was a little piece from a teacher in the paper this morning saying, you know, basically the state provides no money for supplies. You know, and on a technical point, she is correct in that the funding for school supplies from the state perspective has been reduced. But in doing that, what the state has provided is actual additional flexibility for local districts to use other funds to buy school supplies. That's always left out of the argument. You know, that local districts can use, more funds to actually pay for school supplies. All they focus on most of the time is that the actual funding for that particular item or category has gone down, which is true, but local districts can use additional categories now to actually access funds for schools, but that part of the story never gets on.
Well, and they have to pay their superintendents large salaries and perks and vacation homes and stuff like that, which I guess is a topic for another day. We'll leave it right there. Bob Lipke, Senior Education Policy Analyst at the Civitas Institute. Thank you so much for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina and helping us understand teacher compensation a little better.
Good to be here, Mark.
All right. We're going to take a break for Fox News and get you caught up there. And on the other side, we'll talk to Kevin Mooney of the Daily Signal. Some attorney generals want to prosecute climate change deniers. Oh, boy. Mark Shiver here. We'll be right back. This is What Matters in North Carolina.
Radio, I'm Lisa Brady. The Democratic nominee reaching out to Bernie Sanders supporters and Republicans on a hot-button issue for the economy. Fox Radio's Jared Halpern, live in Washington.
On a factory floor outside of Detroit, Hillary Clinton made her economic pitch to working and middle-class voters.
My message to every worker in Michigan and across America is this. I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages.
Including the Democratic nominee says the Trans-Pacific Partnership favored by President Obama. It's a similar promise as one made by Republican nominee Donald Trump. But Clinton challenges Trump's seriousness. Lisa.
Jared, Hillary Clinton also wants more infrastructure spending and a tax hike on the rich. Donald Trump in Miami Beach.
The people are starting to really get it. I mean, the people understand they're smart.
Telling home builders before Clinton's speech she'll just be four more years of President Obama and hurt the middle class instead of helping. Some 70 Republicans so far signing a draft letter that calls Trump dishonest, ill-prepared, and incompetent. They plan to send it to party chair Reince Priebus.
These petitioners, which include members of past presidential campaigns going back to the Reagan administration, it includes lots of former members of the Republican National Committee, as well as some former members of Congress. And they're saying that the RNC should stop giving money and resources to the Trump campaign if he doesn't curb his rhetoric.
Fox's Carl Cameron in Kissimmee, where Trump holds a rally later today. Despite successful efforts to legalize marijuana in some states, it will remain an illegal drug under federal law. The DEA refusing to take it off the list of drugs considered dangerous with no accepted medical use. However, the government is open to possible expansion of the number of agencies legally growing pot for medical research. Record day on Wall Street, the Dow up 117 to a new closing high after hitting an all-time high in the session. Fair and balanced.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him opening his own clothing store at the age of 18? 1 in 138,000. Excited to be a part of pop culture, he packed for the big city. The odds of finding someone to invest in his vision? 1 in 4.5 million. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
A Mississippi woman who once sought to disguise a planned journey to join ISIS as her honeymoon gets 12 years in prison on a terrorism charge. Vicksburg native Jalen Young pleaded guilty in March to one count of conspiring to provide material support to a terrorist organization. Her fiancé pleaded guilty to a similar charge set for sentencing later this month. A search continues in Arizona for a little boy who's been missing for more than 3 weeks.
Police in Buckeye are getting help from the FBI as they look for 10-year-old Jesse Wilson. They've been specifically searching a large field near his home. Chief Larry Hall told reporters that given the amount of time he's been gone, they're looking at this as a possible recovery operation.
Unfortunately, this scenario is the worst case scenario, and this is a scenario that we have to understand that could have occurred. We can't be naive to this, so we have to do our due diligence and conduct these searches.
Wilson's mother called police after she said she put him to bed on July 18th and noticed a few hours later he was missing. Wilson has been known to slip away from his home before and walk around the neighborhood.
Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal. In South Carolina, a high school football player is dead.
Lewis Simpkins collapsed near the end of a two-hour football practice Wednesday night. Why? They don't know yet, as officials at River Bluff High School await autopsy results. Athletic trainers and a coach started CPR and used a defibrillator on Simpkins until paramedics arrived, but to no avail. The 14-year-old sophomore was pronounced dead at Lexington Medical Center. A school spokeswoman says players took water breaks every 15 to 20 minutes and water hoses and coolers were always available. The team will not practice Thursday, gathering only to share their grief. And a preseason football scrimmage Friday has been canceled. Dave Anthony, Fox News.
Again, Wall Street, the Dow up 117, a new closing high of 18,613. The S&P 500 also with a record close. This is Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Thanks to Bob Lipke there, bringing us some good information about teacher compensation and how if you factor in not only the salaries, which the average salary is targeted at being $50,000 going forward here in North Carolina, then adding to that the benefits, which include health insurance, retirement plan, etc., compensation is, you know, it's not as bad as those on the left would try to make you believe. Bob Lipke always does a really good job with all things education at the Civitas Institute, so we appreciate him being on the program every couple of weeks. And then Nick Oxner, of course, before that from WBTV, talking about a lawsuit filed against somebody, former state director for the Trump campaign. Obviously kind of weird, says he pulled a gun and kind of pointed at his knee while they were driving down the road and then put it away. So I'm not sure what was all up with that, but I guess we'll find out. And then a lobbyist, Mark Bibbs, who was not registered as a lobbyist, used to be a lobbyist, attempting to influence, Insurance Commissioner Wayne Goodwin quite a bit. Their text messages and all kind of information that Nick Oxner has posted at WBTV.com. And, you know, Speaker Tim Moore, people are saying, well, he should have known about this. He knows who Mark Bibbs is and that sort of thing. And I wouldn't necessarily disagree that as the Speaker of the House, he certainly should be aware of these things and that his staff should, you know, be looking at who and who isn't registered as a lobbyist. The Secretary of State provides that information. But a lot of people think Speaker Moore should have known that Mr. Bibbs was not a lobbyist. That being said, really the stuff that makes you raise an eyebrow is the way that he was trying to influence Wayne Goodwin. Of course, nobody will care. The media won't pick this up. Locally, you know, Goodwin's running against Mike Causey. Bless his heart. He's run quite a few times. But, you know, if you read these text messages, you know, it's kind of sickening the way Goodwin was allowing himself to be, you know, here's this guy who's not even registered as a lobbyist, just peddling influence with the insurance commissioner. Hey, bud, let's go to Angus Barn, our treat, you and a guest, you know, and all kinds of things. And I wonder about these things sometimes. What really goes on behind the scenes? I don't guess we really want to know. They always say you don't want to see sausage being made and you don't want to see law being made. And I guess that's true. But, you know, Wayne Goodwin holds himself out as this protector of the public. And here he is dealing quite intimately with a guy who is not registered as a lobbyist and should have been. So, story in the Daily Signal, after being punished for praying, a football coach is filing a lawsuit to get his job back. Kelsey Harkness, our good friend over there at the Daily Signal on Tuesday, published this article. Joe Kennedy is a coach, former coach, and he was fired for praying. And he would go out and stand by himself and say a prayer. And these students asked, the players asked, if they could join him. And so the school district of Bremerton, which is a city located west of Seattle, said they're complying with state and federal law. They placed Kennedy on administrative leave and then did not renew his coaching contract because it's a constitutional violation of students' rights for a district employee to initiate prayer with students. Well, what about the constitutional right for those students that have a freedom of religion? Oh, well, that doesn't matter, Mark. Just stomp all over that, right? So Coach Kennedy, he was an assistant coach for the varsity team there and head coach for the junior varsity. He also worked full-time at the Navy shipyard there. And these people cited a 1995 case called Doe versus Duncanville. While attending games may be voluntary for most students, students required to be present by virtue of their participation in football or cheerleading will necessarily suffer a degree of coercion to participate in religious activity when their coaches lead or endorse it. Well, God forbid that anybody would pray in this country, right? I mean, you know, such a horrible, horrible thing. Now, First Liberty Institute has filed a lawsuit. They are a conservative legal organization, and they're trying to help Coach Kennedy get his job back. They've cited other coaches at the school who engage in religious expression. For example, they noted that assistant coach David Boynton engages in a Buddhist chant near the 50-yard line at the conclusion of many Bremerton High School games. So nobody said anything to him. Nobody's fired him. It's okay for him to chant. Just don't pray. Just don't acknowledge that there is a God in heaven and talk to him. And don't have students around if you do. This is so horrible. Kennedy first applied for a religious accommodation. The school district denied that request. They told him to stop it. He defied their orders, continued praying on the 50-yard line. And so they put him on administrative leave and banned him from participating in the football program in any capacity. So football season's about to start. He's thinking, you know, I really ought to be out there with my team. This is ridiculous. So they have filed a suit in the U.S. District Court in the Western District of Washington. So, you know, here we have people who are adjudicating that, by golly, you're not going to coerce kids to pray. Even though you're not making them, even though it's voluntary, even though they don't have to be involved in it at all. Just the mere fact that you're praying, oh, well, that's coercive and divisive and harmful. But the good old Charlotte Observer, well, they just want girls to not be uncomfortable looking at male genitalia. Heaven forbid that they would pray. But let's get this this notion of looking at male genitalia, let's just get that right out there for these young girls. Okay? No prayer, but men in little girls' bathrooms. That's where we are now as a society. You cannot pray. You cannot, unless you're chanting to Buddha, well, that's fine. But no praying to God under any circumstances. However, if you want to expose young girls to male genitalia, according to the Charlotte Observer and their transgender nirvana. Well, this is fine and absolutely normal. And it's a sacrifice that has to be made for the advancement of society. So I don't understand any of this, but that's where we are. So the guest we had yesterday, Baron Soka, was just awesome. And he talked about internet freedom. His website is techfreedom.org. And you need to go there because today they were sending a letter to House Speaker Paul Ryan and Majority Leader Glenn McConnell, and basically writing to urge Congress to defend its power of the purse as well as internet freedom. I'm not going to read you the entirety of this three-page letter. Thankfully, I'm sure you're saying you don't want me to do that. But the idea is that the National Telecommunications and Information Administration has domain name system functions. And there's all kind of initials here. There's the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, which is under their umbrella. And then ICANN, which is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. And basically right now, if the Congress doesn't fund this entity, which the Obama administration wants the funding to stop or expire, then the possibility exists that the administration of these activities, such as assigning domain names, could revert to other countries. And right now, the United States has the majority of the authority over this stuff. And so he was saying that it might be far-fetched, but he did say that, yeah, sure, it's possible that you could have a website, you know, secondamendmentrights.com. That's what you want to name your website. And they would say no. Again, not to be conspiratorial, but it could happen. And so Congress needs to exercise their power of the purse. And I would encourage you to go to techfreedom.org and read this letter and do whatever you can to support this endeavor. Maybe call your local congressman and Senator Tillis, Senator Burr, and tell them, look, you know, Congress is supposed to have the funding authority over these types of things, and y'all do what you're supposed to do. So go to techfreedom.org, find out more about it. It is a very important issue, and we appreciate Baron Soka of Tech Freedom sharing all about that with us yesterday. In fact, you can go to freedomactionnetwork.com and find yesterday's program very easily. Just scroll down and you can download it as a podcast. You can hear a conversation with him. You can also find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. So Charlotte Observer, mad at Commissioner Bill James. We've already talked about that. He's tweeting that trannies, boys in drag, will not be able to go into the bathroom because the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School District had to postpone their implementation of transgender policy. And they don't like Commissioner James and his comments there at the Charlotte Observer, I guess. And the News Observer reprinted that also about how mean and hateful he is to say such a thing. And even Montel Williams weighed in. You know, he's very, for some reason, very much nosing into North Carolina's stuff. And he was talking about Bill James and his tweet and how hateful it was. And he shouldn't be using the word tranny. Only people in that community can use that word. And so, I mean, he's all over. Here's Montel Williams talking about Representative Ken Goodman and others just all over about North Carolina. And I don't know, maybe he needs a TV show again or something to get something to do. But if you remember, when I first took the reins of this show, Montel Williams was here with the Ben and Jerry's ice cream folks. and they were coming out with some kind of new ice cream flavor. I forget what it was called now, but it was a. They were just here to trash the voting rights law, and I guess they feel pretty vindicated now because of the three-judge panel that struck down that law. But I asked Montel to come on the show, and he either wouldn't or couldn't, but he had his media guy with him, and we arranged it, and he came right on. And so he was like, well, we don't want people to be suppressing the vote. And I said, well, and I explained to him now there was no voter suppression, and you could vote absentee if you want, because he said you should have an absentee ballot program. And I said, well, we do. As a matter of fact, 30 days before an election, you can vote absentee. And he was like, oh. So the guy knew nothing about the law here in North Carolina, and yet Montel Williams is just constantly blabbing about North Carolina as if he, you know, just can't stand our state or takes great pleasure in trying to denigrate the Republican Party.
So, that flavor was Empower Mint.
Oh, that's right. Empower Mint. Yeah. So I guess with the three-judge ruling, we can all go out and order a big bowl of Empower Mint.
I prefer fish food myself.
Well, there you go. So I need to get Montel on the show. He wouldn't come on last time, and I guess he wanted his guy to come on, which he did. But Montel is really sometimes... I just don't know what his deal is with North Carolina. I don't know if he's here. Let's see. His Twitter says, the name behind one of the longest-running talk shows in the history of television. So there you go. Maybe he's still on TV somewhere late night on cable or whatever. But anyway, so, wow, that kind of was a sidetrack. But anyway, I was talking about Commissioner Bill James in Charlotte. And we're trying to get him on the show, and hopefully he'll be on next week. Maybe, maybe not. He's just don't use the word tranny is, I guess, the bottom line from what Montel was trying to tell Commissioner James. So here's something that you don't really hear much about that you really should be aware of, and that is that some faith-based higher education is under attack. And this is in California, but California, unfortunately, often sets the tone for the rest of the country. And there is a law that is being debated in California, Senate Bill 1146, which would greatly and adversely affect faith-based higher education in California. And so some of the schools out there are rallying the cry to contact California legislators and you know, urge them to vote against this. But here's an example. Faith-based institutions would no longer be able to require a profession of faith of their students. They would no longer be able to integrate faith throughout the teaching curriculum. These institutions would no longer be able to require chapel attendance for students, an integral part of the learning experience at a faith-based school. These institutions would no longer be able to require core units of Bible courses. Athletic teams would no longer be able to lead faith-based community service programs. So, you know, what I don't get, it's a Christian school. It's a faith-based school. Why is the California legislature nosing around in that, trying to regulate them? And, you know, a school like Liberty University, for example, in Virginia, I think they're sitting on a lot of money. I mean, they're not hurting. And so I think they would just be able to tell the federal government or the state or whoever, you know, fine, we don't need your money, you know, whatever. But this is a law that California is trying to pass. And if you haven't figured out, folks, that the scope is pointed directly at people of faith and conservatives, well, then you need to wake up and you need to understand that. And I got in a big kind of a disagreement last night with someone in my family. Okay, it was my wife. Because we were engaged in doing some business with a company that has an 800 number, and I had to call them. And in the course of doing the business, the guy was filling out a form, and he was asking name and address and all this. And he says, do you identify as a male or a female? And I said, excuse me? He said, do you identify as a male or a female? And I said, did you really just ask me that? Because all of a sudden now, like turning on a switch, companies have adopted the verbiage of the transgender movement. And I told the guy, I said, I'm a male. And I said, I guess political correctness has wormed its way into your forms there. And he just laughed. So I was telling my wife how I was kind of offended by this. But you see, it's okay to offend me, but we just can't offend somebody who wants to dress up like a woman because that's how they identify on a certain day. But the fact is that for a company that does business all across this country to suddenly adopt this verbiage, to me, it's offensive and insulting because they don't mind if I don't like it. And her point was, well, you can't be mad at this guy, Mark. He's just doing his job. And I said, okay, I get that. But my point was, you know, they know that the vast majority of their customers are not transgender, but they also know we're not going to do anything about it. We're just going to keep accepting and accepting and accepting all of this stuff that denigrates our society, that pulls out the moral fabric of our society, and just keep rolling right along. Well, at some point, somebody's going to have to draw a line and take a stand and say, this is enough. And I came very close. In fact, I still might call this company back and say, look, I'm not doing business with you. I'm offended that you asked me if I identify as a man. You know, it used to be, are you male or female? Male. Because that's the way it is. But now it's, do you identify? What kind of question is that? I should have said, well, on the continuum, I am a, what's one of the things? Curious, asexual, non-binary 3. That's what I should have told him. And I don't think he had a little box to check for that. But the fact of the matter is, folks, that little changes, one at a time, they keep coming in, and nobody is saying anything about them except me and a few others. Nobody's standing up and saying, what are we doing? How much longer are we going to allow this ground to be taken before we say, okay, that's enough. That is absolutely enough. Duck Dynasty's Phil Robertson telling Christians to vote for the biblically correct candidate. I don't know if he thinks that's Donald Trump or if he thinks that's Hillary Clinton. I know that a lot of people would say that Hillary Clinton, Ralph Reed of the Faith and Freedom Coalition called her positions morally evil. And so Robertson said, I'm going to leave that up to you to cast your vote. I would say cast your vote for the one that we have a better chance to remain the republic that we are. He said, you have political correctness on one side, biblical correctness on the other. I'm on the biblically correct side. Therefore, I would tiptoe through the tulips, but you just have to vote your conscience. And so, you know, again, what's going to be next? I keep asking this. What is next, folks? Because you see, you know, with great ease, the movement slid the T onto the LGB. What behavior, what lifestyle choice is going to be next? And we're just all going to have to accept it because we cannot be haters. We cannot be disagreeing with anything that anybody does. It's okay to offend me as a person of faith. It's okay to offend me and millions of others who may not agree with these lifestyle choices. But by golly, we can't offend those who are making these lifestyle choices. So, Mark, do you identify as a man or a woman? That's the question of the day. Finally, today as we run out of time. Democratic Senate candidate said Justice Scalia's death happened, quote, at a good time. Senate candidate, former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland, had to apologize yesterday for saying the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia happened at a good time for labor unions. He said the death of Scalia saved labor from a terrible decision. I don't wish anyone ill, but it happened at a good time, because once that decision had been made, it would have been tough to reverse it. So he backtracked and said that he was apologizing for having said that. And so he's behind, by the way, trailing Senator Rob Portman, who is the Republican from Ohio. So there you go. We've had a crazy show today, but I hope you've enjoyed it. Go to freedomactionnetwork.com. You can listen to any or all of it there as a podcast. You can also find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores. And come back tomorrow, because we've got an amazing lineup for you. This is What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Bye.